The opinions expressed by guests of this show are their own and do not necessarily align with those of us here at the Animal Soulmates podcast.
He knows that his job is to be aggressive. He thinks his job is to bite everything he finds. Everyone he finds, his job is to bite them. And he's got one of the nastiest barks on the team. He's very snarly, which he snarls a lot. So he barks and then he snarls as he draws his breath in, and then he barks again. And it's pretty intimidating.
Welcome to the Animal Soulmates podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Abby Viscardi. I'm an animal welfare scientist and, more importantly, an obsessed dog mom. I believe that the unconditional love and connection that we share with our animals is more powerful than we realize. This podcast will honor the stories of these amazing creatures that have walked with us and changed our lives forever. So join me, and together we will explore the true power of the human-animal bond. Hello, and welcome to the season one finale of the Animal Soulmates podcast. And boy, do we have a banger to end out this season. To give you a little peek behind the curtain of the Animal Soulmates podcast, I have this list of people that I would love to have on the show that aren't named per se, but they have a unique or specific relationship with an animal. So for example, this season, we've heard a lot of dog animal soulmate stories, but I would love to chat with somebody who had a cat animal soulmate or a horse animal soulmate. I imagine these relationships are quite different than a dog animal soulmate. So those are people that are on my list. I would also love to chat with somebody who has a service animal. Again, I think that that relationship would be really interesting to explore because it must be a lot different to have a service animal than to have a companion animal. So anyways, there's this list. There's no person named, but just sort of animal relationships that I'd like to explore. And one of the hopeful guests on my list is a police canine officer. I am personally endlessly fascinated by the abilities of working dogs and what they're able to do. And as working dogs go, I feel like Malinois are the canine prototype. Like, they are what all other canines aspire to be. They just seem to have retained so much more of the wild instincts and drive that are bred out of most of our companion dog breeds, which is obviously what makes them great for the work that they do. Anyways, long story short, I told my significant other, Brandon, that I was hoping to chat with a police officer who had a canine partner, and he was the one who sent me the Instagram account with Sergeant O'Reilly and Radar. Brandon had been sending their videos for a while prior to this. I always loved their videos. They were so fun to watch. They had Sergeant O'Reilly sharing a snack with Radar, his canine partner. And so I reached out to Sergeant O'Reilly, and he agreed to sit down with me and chat about all things Radar and what his experience has been working with the canine unit at the Washington County, Oregon's Sheriff's Office. And I'm going to plug their Instagram page right out of the gate because it's so good. And it is deputy_dog_radar. So go give it a follow and enjoy episode 12, A Police Canine Named Radar.
Hi, I'm Eamon O'Reilly. I am a sergeant with the Washington County Sheriff's Office. I'm a canine handler. Radar is my partner. Been at the sheriff's office for just about 20 years, just coming up on 20 years. And I've been a canine handler for 9. Radar's been my partner for 9 years.
And so can you talk a little bit about what initially drew you to a career in law enforcement?
It's actually I don't know if it's a boring story or not, but I had no interest in law enforcement my whole entire life, right up actually until I even got the job. I was raised in a military family. My dad was in the Navy. He was an officer in the Navy. And we moved around a bunch. We lived in California our whole lives, but we moved up and down the coast. And there are a couple of types of kids in military families. There's kids that dress in their father's fatigues and or their parents' fatigues and want to be in the military. And then there's kids like me who were skate brats and wanted nothing to do with the military. And so got married relatively young. I was 20 when I got married and just lived paycheck to paycheck for most of my young adult life. And in my late 20s, my dad suggested, we were living up here in Washington County at the time in Oregon. And my dad sent me a link to the county's website and they were offering dispatcher jobs. And that sounded awful. I didn't want to be a dispatcher. So I decided to look and see what else they had. And I saw they were hiring deputies. And I remember this day, we were living in a condo. And I remember going halfway down the stairs, leaning over the rail. And my wife was facing away from me. She was facing the TV. And I asked her, I said, "Hey, what do you think about me being a cop?" And I was expecting her to laugh at me. But I think she was just so frustrated that I wasn't working a real job, that I didn't have a career, that she turned around and she told me that she said that sounded like a great idea. And so I thought, oh, okay, I guess I'll try then. So I went and applied and I got the job. I started off working in the jail. The sheriff's office, I don't know how it works everywhere else, but in Oregon, the sheriff is responsible for staffing a jail. And so I started off in the jail and I got the job before ever even setting foot in the jail. So I had no idea what I was getting into. So that's where I started. That's how I started. I started out of desperation, basically.
So what was that like working in a jail?
It was interesting. I enjoyed it. Not enough to stay, obviously. I spent just under 4 years before going to the patrol division. Back then, you couldn't just transfer to the patrol division. It was a whole other job. I applied for the patrol division, just like any person that didn't work for the sheriff's office. I went through the whole application process. But the jail was, it was interesting. It taught, I wouldn't make it mandatory for anyone who wanted to work in patrol, but people who start in the jail tend to make better patrol officers because you learn a lot of skills working with inmates that you don't get working at patrol. So we call it the jail is a direct supervision environment. So it's not what most people think of when they think of jails. You think of bars on doors and long hallways full of bars and cells. The jail is called direct supervision. So it's basically a giant room with, I think it was 56 cells in it. Some of those cells are two-person cells. So there's up to 60 inmates in that we call them a pod. And when it's rec time or when it's out time, we just basically open the doors and it's one deputy standing in the middle of a room with 60 inmates walking around doing their thing, eating or walking or watching TV or whatever. And we say the only reason we go home safe every day is because they let us. And we learn a lot about how to communicate, how to talk with people. Being able to communicate in an environment like that can save your life. And so we learn how to communicate. We learn how to have great awareness of space. And so once people have been in there for a few years and they go out to patrol like I did, it's just they come to the world with a different awareness, personal safety than people who just start in patrol. I'm glad that I moved to patrol because patrol has it's just a larger arena and there are more options for collateral duties. The jail, basically, you can work in the jail. If you work an entire career in the jail, you can do every job the jail has to offer. You can be each rank and you can do every special team and you can do each assignment. And over the course of a career, you can do all of it. In patrol, there are so many more options that you can't do everything. You have to, within a few years, pick a path and take that path throughout your career and just hope that you pick the path that you enjoy. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to go to patrol instead of the jail. I could have worked in the jail my whole career and been happy and had a good career, but I'm very happy that patrol has worked out for me.
So then transitioning into patrol, is that how you got involved with the canine unit?
Well, it used to be the only way to become a part of the canine team. I'm currently in the process of starting a jail detection dog program. So you're going to be able to join the team now in the jail, but patrol used to be the only way to join the canine team. And again, it wasn't a goal that I had. A lot of my career choices haven't been goals. They've just been opportunities that have just landed in my lap, basically. I've just put myself in a position for things to work out well for me. And a few years, I was working in patrol for about 4 years before I joined the canine team. And what I did was I actually wasn't a huge fan of dogs.
Interesting.
Animals in general, wasn't a huge animal fan. And anytime we deal with dogs a lot in patrol, and anytime there was a dog, a loose dog, or sometimes people would find dogs and just tie them up to trees or whatever, so they wouldn't keep running around, but they didn't want to have to deal with them. So anytime we deal with a dog, I'd try to get someone else to come help because dogs don't like me, or at least I thought dogs didn't like me. And so I just didn't want to deal with dogs. And so I thought, well, what better person to go help the canine team and be the guy that goes and hides from dogs and be the guy that gets bit by dogs than a guy that dogs don't like? And so that's how it started. And through the time that I spent the canine team putting on the bite suit or the bite sleeve or hiding in cars or running around town and hiding in bushes and stuff, I started to really appreciate the level of work that went into it and the amount of time and effort that they put into the craft. And that's when I decided that I wanted to be a part of that team.
So I've always wanted to ask this. What does it feel like when a dog bites, when you're in a bite suit or you have that thing on your arm that the dogs bite? Like, how does that actually feel?
Yeah, well, it evolves. It depends. And physically, it can actually be really painful, depending on the type of suit, because there's different types of suits. Mentally, it's scary. Like, the first time it happened, it was just a sleeve that I wore. And they said, they didn't tell me anything. We do a much better job of teaching we call them decoys or quarries. We do a much better job of teaching the decoys how to wear the sleeve or how to wear the suit or how to take a bite is the way we say it. But initially, they just put me out in the field and they said, all right, here he comes. And I just got this massive German Shepherd just barreling down at me and just scared because I'm just hoping that this dog is going to bite what they tell me this dog is going to bite. But it's physically demanding. You want to stay on your feet, and these heavy dogs coming in to bite, it can hurt your entire body, really. But depending on what you're wearing, it can hurt. We buy the old, if you watch videos where guys are wearing giant, thick, puffy suits, those suits don't hurt. Like the dog, you can't hardly feel anything with those suits, but they're also not very maneuverable. All you do is you stand there. You can't move around. And those are great for sport training but a lot of the dogs do bite work just for sport, not police work. And those dogs, it's fine for them to bite those big giant puffy suits, but it doesn't simulate biting a real person. So when we're doing it with police work, we want a suit that the dog can actually feel the muscle and the bone through the suit when it's biting. And so it makes sense. And it's just logical. If the dog can feel the muscle and the bone through the suit, well, then I can feel the jaw and the teeth through the suit. And so we buy, they're competition suits. And you can buy different thicknesses of competition suits. And our competition suits can be pretty painful. It protects us from lacerations. And it protects us from punctures and lacerations and broken bones, but it doesn't protect us from bruising. We can go away pretty beat up. And it depends on the dogs. Some dogs are just brutal. This last summer, I was taking bites, and Portland Police Department has a dog that's just psychotic. And I didn't want to take any more bites from this dog because it hurt. It hurts. And then you get bruised. And your bruises, then the dog starts biting the bruises. And the dogs like certain places when they bite. Dogs choose where they want to bite. And we try to teach them to bite available areas. And so a lot of dogs don't like to bite a leg, or they don't like to bite a back, or they don't like to bite a hip or something. And so it takes us a long time to train a dog that if that's available, you can bite it. Because some dogs just won't bite an area if they can't reach it, like Radar. Used to not bite anything but legs. If you couldn't reach your leg, you weren't going to get bit. Your whole upper body could be available and he wasn't going to bite you because he couldn't get to your leg. So some dogs are like that. We have to teach them to bite certain areas. So some dogs the worst dogs when you're wearing the suit are the dogs that like elbows, because some dogs just like elbows, and they're going to go and they're going to reach and they're going to bite your elbow every single time. And it hurts a lot. So depending on the dog and depending on how long you've been in the suit, they can actually hurt. It hurts a lot.
So I might be getting ahead of myself here, but are they being trained to bite and hold? Is that the idea?
Yes. Yeah. So we don't, police work, the dogs aren't trained to inflict pain. It kind of hurt. That's just a nature of being bit by a dog, but it's not punitive. We teach the dogs to bite and hold. And that's actually one of the reasons the dog might not pass a school or might not be chosen is because they bite and chew, or because they bite and release and bite and release and bite and release. Usually though, dogs bite, and when a dog is attempting to inflict damage, that's usually a dog that's scared and it's trying to hurt something or kill something. Our dogs, we don't choose, or we try to choose dogs that don't bite out of fear. We choose dogs that we can teach how to bite as a part of their job. And so their job is to bite and hold, and we teach them, we reward the dogs as part of the training. We reward them for biting and holding, and actually for, sometimes they do what we call a re-grip, and it's a lot of the times when a dog bites, it gets a frontal bite. So it's only getting the bite initially out on the front of its mouth, which is where the damage, those are the teeth that cause the damage, or the canines and the teeth out front. And so we teach the dog, because a lot of times their bodies are moving, bodies move, people move. Rarely are people still when the dog bites them. And so when they go to bite, they get a lot of just the front of their mouth on the bite. And so we teach them to re-grip, which just means they're just going to open their mouth and push their muzzle forward and then bite down again with the back of their mouth. And those teeth cause less damage, and it puts more of the mouth on the body, which is going to cause less damage. It's going to spread the surface area of the bite out. And then they hold. And they hold because their job is to hold somebody so that the police can then go take that person into custody. So yes, we train to bite and hold, not bite and chew.
Not bite and keep biting.
Yeah.
So how do you train a dog then that's more inclined to just bite with the front of its teeth, or to bite a certain area? How do you then teach that dog, oh no, we want you to bite a different way?
Teaching a dog to bite, and let's say a dog bites just out on the front of its mouth, sometimes that dog won't make it through training. Like, that dog won't get chosen, because a lot of the times a dog that bites out on the front of its mouth is scared of the person it's biting. And so it's trying to do its job without getting any closer to the person because it's scared of the person. And so it's going to do the least amount possible. And so we don't want a dog that's scared of people, because a lot of dogs we breed, that dogs are now mostly pets. And so we breed dogs that are not aggressive. And so it's actually difficult sometimes to teach a dog that it's allowed to bite someone on purpose. And so a lot of the dogs are just afraid to do it. But one of the ways we do it is if the dog will, we put some pressure. We call it pressure. It's pressure on the dog's psyche to bite. If the dog's scared to bite, it's a lot of pressure. And so the dog gets rewarded for doing the thing we ask it to do. We reward with toys. We reward with tug toys. Basically, you can reward with food, you can reward with a tug toy. But one of the ways we do it with a decoy is we reward with the release of pressure. So the decoy, if the dog's afraid of the decoy, if the dog's afraid of the person and it's biting on just the front of its mouth, we'll go up to the dog. So sometimes the decoy could be leaning over the dog or staring at the dog and looking at the dog and creating pressure. And so the handler will go up to the dog and physically take the harness and push the dog into the decoy. And if the dog re-bites while we're doing that, because sometimes that's all it takes is a little help from the handler, we push the dog in. And if it re-bites, that decoy's job is to then release some pressure. They can turn away and look away from the dog, or they can crouch down a little bit. Or sometimes what we do is we encourage the decoy to pretend to make noises like you just got hurt. And that encourages the dog and it strengthens the dog's psyche and it makes the dog feel like it just won. And so then it starts to learn that when it pushes in and re-grips, it's going to be rewarded by the decoy, who is going to then make a noise like it got hurt or turn away and release that pressure. So the dogs start to learn that the better grip they get, the more they're going to win. And so we try to make it less scary for the dog when it bites harder or when it bites in deeper. That's just one of the methods we use.
And so are these dogs typically purpose bred for doing this kind of work? Or, I mean, I'm sure it's different. It's not probably consistent everywhere, but within your division.
Yeah. So we choose the breeds that will do this kind of work for us. And we get mostly dogs that are bred in Europe. And there's kennels all over the United States that they send people over to Europe, and they choose the dogs to bring back to the United States. One of the main reasons is because Europe has much higher standards for breeding animals than we do in the United States. In the United States, you can just, mm-hmm. anyone can breed an animal. Anyone can do it. You can just breed an animal, and people don't know what they're doing. And they just breed animals because they want to make puppies, mm-hmm. and they want to sell puppies, and they want more puppies. And what people don't understand is they're, a lot of these times, they're breeding inferior animals. They're breeding animals that are aggressive, or they're breeding animals that aren't healthy. And so we end up in the United States with a lot of animals that just, they're beautiful animals and they make great pets, but they're not good for police work because they can't handle the physical toll that we're asking them to do, even if some of them want to do the work. But most of them also just don't want to do the work we're asking, because people over here are breeding pets and we don't want a pet. We want a dog we can teach to bite somebody, or that has a good hunt drive. And so it's more about the breed, which is why we typically choose Shepherds and Malinois, is because they have all of the parts. They have all of the virtues that we want in a police dog. They're a good weight. They're willing to work. They will work for their handler. They'll work for toys and for food. They're sturdy. They can be taught to be aggressive. They're a tenacious breed, and they will do all of the things. They will bite, but they won't bite too hard, because there are breeds out there that would make great police dogs, but they bite too hard. Because we don't, like I said, we don't want a broken bone. But they can also they're scary. We need our dogs to look scary as much as we need them to be scary, or actually be aggressive. We need them to appear aggressive. A lot of people we find and we capture without any biting, because people just don't want to run from a police dog. And so it helps to have a scary dog. Hounds are great tracking dogs. We do a lot of tracking, and hounds would be fantastic, but hounds aren't scaring anybody. No one's coming out of a hiding place because a hound is about to find them. So the Shepherds and Malinois have just every feature we want in a police dog.
I was just talking about this the other day, but it's so funny in these police videos that are on YouTube and whatnot. You can have 10 guys with guns, and the second someone says, "Come out now, or we're sending the canine in," the guy's like, "Okay, I'm out. Like, don't send the dog in." It's crazy that the dog instills so much more fear, the idea of getting bit by this dog, than 10 guys with guns pointed.
Yeah, we talk about that too. And part of that is because there are rules. Like, I have rules with my gun, and the people in the house or the people who are running or hiding, they know the rules. They know when cops are allowed to use their guns and when they're not. And they understand the rules. They know that there are fewer rules with the dog. Like, they know that I know the rules, but the dog doesn't know the rules. When the dog comes running into the house to look for you, people know I can't just say, "Okay, I'm going to give up." That dog doesn't understand that language, and it does not care. They're unpredictable is one of the differences.
So how did your transition from being a decoy then move on to getting radar and now having a canine colleague?
I decided that I wanted to be one of the handlers. I decided that because I like problem solving, and I like being able to use a tool to problem. It bothers some people that I call the police dogs tools, but they're tools. I don't mean that derogatory. I just mean physically they're a tool. And so I like the aspect of knowing how to do new tasks. And so I thought I would love to have this tool and learn how to use this tool properly in order to find suspects. And so I still, even when I got Radar, I was really nervous about getting him because I still didn't like dogs. I didn't like dogs and I thought dogs still don't like me. So I thought this is going to be interesting having this dog in the back of my car. He's going to have to learn that I'm the boss and who his boss is. And that's how it started. It started off with me thinking like, this is just another piece of equipment in my car that I can use to solve incident or solve problem. It actually went that way for a while. He's been my partner for 9 years, and going through the training was frustrating because I had never trained a dog before. He had never been trained before. And so while we were going through, school's a 400-hour school. It's 10 hours a day, 4 days a week for 10 weeks. And that's a lot of time to spend with the dog, but that's a lot of time to also get frustrated with one piece of equipment. And so we didn't really build our relationship, what people see now. That took years to build because mostly it was just me learning how to teach Radar how to do what we wanted him to do. And we wanted him to find people. We wanted him to be able to track people and find people. So it was a very frustrating first couple of years just trying to teach him. And he's not the most affectionate dog, which actually I think really worked out well for me because I love animals now. I love dogs. I love Radar, but I'm still not the most affectionate person towards animals. So it's actually worked out really well that he's pretty nonchalant about contact with people because he's not the kind of dog that is constantly coming up to me, wanting me to pet him or want to lay down with me or want to be next to me. He doesn't really want much to do with me when we're out, just out and about. He couldn't care less if I was around, as long as he gets to go out and run around and hunt. That actually worked out really well. But it took a couple of years before I became comfortable enough in my role as a canine handler to start appreciating the dog's personalities and Radar's personality. Because for me, it was about being confident in my canine handling skills. And for a couple of years, I wasn't. For a few years, I felt like I didn't know what I was doing. We weren't finding people. I wasn't helpful. And so it wasn't a time for me to build this friendly relationship with my dog. It was this, I was not being helpful on patrol. And so once I started learning how to do the job, and once Radar and I started finding people and things started to click, then I started focusing on, okay, now I can actually be friends with this dog because he knows what he's doing and I know what I'm doing and we can relax a little bit. So when I relaxed a little bit and gained some confidence as a canine handler, then I started to actually build a relationship with Radar.
So do they not match dog personality to handler and eventual partner, or this is your dog? And
it depends. It all depends. Okay. That does happen. That can happen. So like we're now, if you know who your handler is, sometimes you choose the dog before you choose the handler. If you have the dog in advance, you don't get to pair them up. Well, here's the dog and here's the handler. This is what you're getting. And it depends on the amount of effort and time and money you have, because it costs money. It's expensive to go find a police dog. Like we're in Oregon. Most of the kennels where police go to be able to choose with a bunch of dogs, the kennels are out of state. Pennsylvania, there's a lot in California. We go to California, but they're all over the country. So the agency has to be willing to pay thousands of dollars for us to go to a place that has a bunch of dogs to choose from. And sometimes they only have two or three dogs. Sometimes they have 15 or 16. And so it's more important to find a dog that we believe has the personality to be a police dog than it is to find a police dog that matches the personality of the handler. If we have five or six dogs that we think all of these dogs are going to be great police dogs, then it would be helpful to say, okay, this dog's a little too strong for this new handler, or this dog's not strong enough for this experienced handler. Then we can pick. But if the priority is choosing the dog that we think will do the police work.
So you were talking about some of the tasks that Radar's trained to do. What specifically have you focused him on?
So we are in Oregon, at least in our area of Oregon, and in Oregon just in general, Pacific Northwest, I guess, we track. We do a lot of tracking. So we consider our dogs locating tools. Other states have other rules for their dogs. California, they're basically in California, they're only going to use their dog to search for violent felons. So anytime they take their dog out of the car, it's just to do an area search to go, the dog's going to go bite somebody. Up here, we're a locating tool. The dogs are a locating tool. So we do a lot of tracking. So we put our dogs, and because we do tracking and because we can control our dogs because they're on leashes, we can search for people that aren't felons. And the governmental interest for us is really low for searching for somebody. We can track for somebody that maybe just stole a Snickers from a 7-Eleven and ran away. We can track for that with our dogs. Other states think we're crazy and they couldn't imagine being able to use their police dogs for a misdemeanor crime. But we can do it because we don't bite people, we locate people. And his primary role is tracking. He's not the best tracker because he's a little bit lazy. He's great now. He's actually really good now that he's 10 years old and almost ready to retire. It took a long time, but he's lazy. And so he doesn't like to put his head, he doesn't like to put his nose on the ground, which is where the odor is. I mean, there's odor comes off the ground and the odor floats around a little bit, and he would prefer to get the odor out of the air. So it takes us a little longer, but he tracks. We do tracking and building searching. His best skill is building searching because he doesn't have to put his nose on the ground. For building searching is looking for pockets of air and pockets of odor that are, they can be on the ground and air falling from above. But he's really good at building searching because he never quits. He'll just keep going and going. He'll search forever. And he's comfortable in uncomfortable environments. So he doesn't mind stepping on weird stuff or climbing on couches or getting up on the counters, going into crawl spaces. He's really good with crawl spaces and attics, stepping over beams and attics and sifting through insulation and that kind of stuff. So he's really good at that kind of stuff. Building search is his forte, but his skill, his task is basically just tracking human odor. He's a tracking dog.
So then what does he do when he finds the target?
Well, it depends on whether he has access or not. Generally, when we're tracking, I can control him. He's never had a bite while tracking. So there's a couple of options while tracking. Basically, the two options while tracking is we're going to find somebody and they're going to surrender, or we're going to find somebody and they're going to run. And no one's ever run from us. So I've never had to release him to go bite someone who ran from us. Anyone we find tracking has just stayed there and been arrested. His job is to be aggressive, though. He knows that his job is to be aggressive. He thinks his job is to bite everything he finds. Everyone he finds, his job is to bite them. And he's got one of the nastiest barks on the team. He's very snarly, which he snarls a lot. So he barks and then he snarls as he draws his breath in, and then he barks again. And it's pretty intimidating. So that's his job, because that scares people and that's why people don't run. So his job is to bite when he finds them. So tracking, he's never bit anyone because no one's ever run. Building searches is where he gets all of his bites. And most of the time, it's because he's not on a leash. It's very difficult to search a building on a leash. We start with leashes and we do as much of a building as we can on a leash. But eventually, we just have to let him off the leash. And so when he's off the leash, then he's going to bite. If he can find someone and he has access to that person, he's going to bite that person, which he does and he has done. But if he can't find somebody, and this is what's more difficult to train, is when they can't bite somebody but have found where the person is. We call it the source. When they've found the source of the odor, because it might not necessarily be the person, they're trained to find odor. They're not trained to find people. So it seems like semantics, and it's actually more important when you talk about this when dogs are searching for narcotics or explosives. But they're not trained to find a person, they're trained to find the odor. And so the dogs eventually learn when they are as close to a person as they can get without being able to reach that person. And their job is to, we call it alert, their job is to bark. and scratch. We don't necessarily teach them to scratch. Some of them just do because they want to get through whatever is the barrier. And the dogs that don't work out well are the dogs that when they find the person or when they get as close to as they can to somebody and they can't reach them, some dogs just decide, well, why would I stay here? And I'm going to give human thought to a dog, but they think, why would I stay here? I can't reach this person. And then they just go leave and they go try to find someone else that they can reach. Mm-hmm. And that's not helpful to us. So we teach the dogs that when they have gotten as close as they can, if they can't have access, they're going to just sit there and bark. And so what that does for us is that allows us the opportunity to move up to where the dog is barking, knowing that's most likely as close as that dog can get to a suspect. And so we can infer that we can go that far too without coming across the person. Now, we still take all the precautions we can while we're clearing our way and getting up there safely. Sometimes we don't leave the dog there. We'll let the dog bark for a while so we know that it's consistently barking at a certain spot. And then even if we can't see him, because a lot of times we can't see where the dog is because it's out roaming around in a building, we'll call the dog back to us. And then when we get back up to the area where it's alerting, we'll send it off again to pinpoint exactly where it was alerting so we'll know specifically where to go. So that's his role in building searching.
So in situations where he's going into a crawl space or going into an attic where there is not kind of an easy exit, how do you ensure that he's safe going into those areas? Or is it kind of a non-threatening situation if there's a Malinois against a human?
No, it can be threatening. We try to mitigate that danger by not sending the dog. So let's, for example, we don't ever, I don't want to say never, we rarely send a dog into an environment where somebody, where we know somebody has a weapon that can hurt the dog. If I know that somebody has a gun, or if I know that somebody has a knife, we have other ways to get that person out of the house. We like to use, we probably actually aren't even in the house if that's happening. We like to break windows. A lot of the time we encourage people to come out and we use we call it an escalation of force. We don't just automatically blow the house up. That's not the first step. The first step, we start very low. And depending on what the situation is, we call it a lone barricade. If someone is in a house, there's no one else in the house, they're not threatening anybody, they're just in there by themselves and we want them out, there's no hurry to get them out. So we call it an escalation of force and we start low, and low is basically just yelling. And we ramp up our force, and sometimes just taking a door off a house or breaking a window, it's intrusive enough that people start to think, that, okay, they're serious. When we start to break things, people realize we're actually being serious. And so they may come out. We may introduce pepper spray. We have ways of putting pepper spray into a house without actually just walking up to it and spraying it. We may introduce gas, CS gas, not smoke, but tear gas, basically. And those are the kind of ways that we will try to get somebody out of an area if we think they are dangerous enough. So we try to mitigate that danger by not sending the dog in. When I send a dog in a crawl space, or when I send Radar into a crawl space or an attic, it's obviously a possibility. It's always a possibility that somebody has a weapon, but I don't have any information that a person has a weapon. So I'm making the assumption that he's being sent in to an environment that's just another person. And Radar, he's no dummy. If someone's trying to hurt him, if someone has the ability to hurt him, he'll leave. He's been hurt. He's been kicked in the face by a guy. He was trying to bite a guy's leg and the guy kicked him in the face several times and that wasn't enough to deter him. He'll physically get hurt, but he's not going to allow someone to kill him. He'll leave. People ask me all the time if he's ever, you know, they say things like, you know, it's so wonderful. This dog would be willing to lay his life down for you. And I was like, Radar would not lay his life down for me. He's not going to save my life knowingly.
Does he wear the bulletproof vest?
He does. Yeah. Canine Storm is the name of the company that makes, it's really the only company that makes a ballistic vest that's wearable on duty all day. We've had ballistic vests for years, but they're heavy and they're bulky, and they're something that we have to put on the dog, or there's something we used to have to be able to put on the dog for an incident if we believed the dog needed to wear more protection. And then they're heavy and they're bulky, and so the dogs couldn't work as long, and they weren't as mobile, couldn't jump on furniture or crawl around as much because they were bulky. And dogs are weird. When you teach a dog a task, a lot of times you put a new item on top of the dogs. We put cameras on our dogs sometimes, or we put collars on, or helmets, or booties. But a lot of times you put an item on a dog, and all of a sudden it doesn't know how to do all of the stuff you've taught it before. And so we have to reteach a dog how to do its job when we put something like a ballistic vest on. Well, now they have these vests that are light enough and pliable enough that the dogs can wear them all day. So I never have to think about it. He's wearing a ballistic vest. The problem with dogs and ballistic vests is they're helpful, but they're not as helpful as they are for people. Because when I wear a ballistic vest, I wear a ballistic vest at work, and my vest covers my chest. It covers all my vital organs, basically. And it covers me when I'm facing a person. Well, dogs' vests don't cover them when they're facing a person.
Yeah.
They cover them when they're sideways to a person. Well, dogs don't attack people sideways. Dogs attack people facing them. That's not covered. Ballistic vests don't cover a dog when it's facing a person. So they are helpful, but they're not as helpful as they are for me. And dogs still get shot, and dogs still get stabbed, and dogs still die, even if they're wearing ballistic vests, because they're just not as helpful as they are for people.
Is it required that they do wear a vest, though?
No. So it's not even required that they wear a vest at all. There are agencies across the country, some of them that just have dogs with collars. There's at least in Oregon, there's no statutory requirement that the dog wears a harness or a vest. We do it for mostly for utilitarian reasons. It's so I can attach a leash to different parts of his vest for different types of searches, or it's got a handle on it and I can pick him up with the handle. It's easier to pick him up and put him on my shoulders, or pick him up and put him over a fence. But it also has the added bonus that it identifies him as a police dog, because it's got the same, he wears a black vest with yellow sheriff patches on the side of it. And actually, the same badge, I wear a Velcro badge on my vest. And so it's the same badge that I wear. So it identifies him as a police dog. So that's the additional bonus of wearing a vest, but it's not mandatory.
So something we had chatted about earlier was the difference in a working dog and a companion dog. So you have dogs that are classified as companions, and then you have Radar, who's your partner, your working dog. What is your bond like, or your relationship like, between these two groups of dogs?
Yeah, it's definitely different. I spend about the same amount of time with, so I have two, my wife has a dog. It's not my dog. It's my wife's dog. It's a toy Australian Shepherd. It's 8-9 pounds. Her name is Havoc. She's, I think, 15 years old. And so we've had Havoc longer than I've cared about dogs, because I told you I didn't like dogs. I wasn't really a dog person when I joined the canine team. That was 9 years ago. But we've had Havoc for 15. Havoc's never been my favorite. It's my wife's dog, and she's fine. She's fine. She's just, I don't have much of a relationship with Havoc. Havoc doesn't care too much about me, because I never cared too much about Havoc. We tolerate each other. So my pet is another Malinois. Bullet is my pet's name. And I got him as a rescue. Up here, a lot of the rescues don't advertise their Malinois, just because it's a breed that we don't really recommend to be pets, which is why a lot of them end up in rescues. And so they contacted me directly. Someone that worked for the rescue knew that I was a handler and contacted me directly. And they just sent me this picture of Bullet when he was like 5 weeks old. And I didn't even have to meet him. I just decided based on the picture that I was going to get him. So I got him when he was about 5 weeks old. And we spend about the same amount of time together each day. It's just in different places. Radar's at work. He's in the car with me, sometimes in the office, or we're out training. It's a job. There's not a lot of, we don't sit on the couch together. We don't eat popcorn together. It's a job. Basically, anytime I have Radar with me, we're working. And anytime I'm with Bullet. It's in the house, and Bullet's a couch dog, and he's just either laying on the bed or sitting on his bed or sitting on the couch with me while I'm reading or drinking coffee or something. And actually don't do much training with Bullet. I got him and I thought, I know how to train dogs. I know how to train Malinois. I was like, this is going to be great. I'm going to have one of those show dogs that, well, they make videos about on YouTube. I'm going to have this amazingly trained Malinois. And I just don't care when I get home. I just don't have the time or the energy to train him. So he's very basic training. We never go out the door without being on a leash because he's a wild dog. He's a Mal. He wants to kill other things as much as Radar wants to kill other things. So we have a different relationship. He's not as alpha as Radar. Radar thinks he's the boss of everybody but me. And Bullet knows that he's not the alpha. Bullet knows everyone else is in charge. Everyone in the house is in charge except for him, in charge of him. They play together once in a while. I get them out together. It took a few months of getting them used to each other before I let them out together. And Radar doesn't care for other dogs. He's not aggressive towards other dogs. He would just prefer every other dog leave him alone. He just doesn't want anything to do with other dogs. And so Bullet loves to play with them. And he's fairly aggressive when he plays. So I tend to not make them play together because Radar just wants Bullet to leave him alone. And eventually he gets tired of it and he grabs Bullet by the neck and he'll slam him down on the ground. And that'll solve it for 30 seconds. But yeah, my relationship with Radar is basically all business. Bullet's just my pet.
And so do you feel like your bond is different, or do you feel like you're just as bonded to both of these animals? You're just classifying them in different ways.
I'd say the bond is a little different, but the bond is a little different mostly because my pet Bullet has really bonded with my wife and he's her dog. If we're on the couch, he's going to sit with her. He sits with her on the bed. He protects her. And so I generally don't let them out together, the Radar and Bullet out together outside if my wife is home or if she's in the living room, because Bullet will protect her and attack Radar because he thinks Radar's going to come get her. I don't know why, but he attacks Radar if my wife is home. So I can't let them out together if my wife is home. So it's basically her dog now, but the bond is different because of the different work we do. Radar and I really have a much stronger relationship than Bullet and I do. Because of the type of time we spend together.
That makes sense. And we had also chatted a little bit about Malinois in general, and we'll talk about your amazing Instagram in a minute, but how we see these videos on Instagram and TikTok, for those that have TikTok, of these just gorgeous dogs, and they can do so many different things. But thinking about them as like a pet versus a working dog, I guess, would you recommend a Malinois as a pet for the average dog owner?
I don't. I discourage people from getting Mals. And I try not to talk about Bullet too much because he just ended up not being a standard house Malinois. He's just not. He does have a lot of the traits that Malinois have that I recommend, for the reasons I recommend people not having him. He's very aggressive towards people that he doesn't know. I have to put him up anytime someone comes over to the house that he doesn't know. I have to put him in the crate. I have to put him up because he's very aggressive. He's very protective. And it's not just, he doesn't just attack people. He waits until he thinks they're threatening my wife. So if someone walks up behind my wife or if someone gets too close to her, then he gets very aggressive. He also murders animals. He murders other animals. And so it's a very aggressive breed. And the videos that people see on TikTok or YouTube or in the movies show, they're great examples of what the dogs can do and what the dogs are capable of doing. But what they don't show is how many hours of training go into the dog's ability to do that. You can't just buy a Malinois and bring it home and watch it walk on a tightrope, because they can walk on a tightrope. But it takes years of training and hours a day of training. Most people don't even have the willpower or the time to teach their dogs basic obedience. People are not going to be able to spend the amount of time it takes to train the dogs to the skill level that they see on social media. It's an aggressive breed.
Yeah. We actually, oddly enough, where we live in Kansas, there's a lot of people with shepherds. And we've noticed this trend of people getting shepherds. And then they'll be like, I don't know, a few months go by and there's a canine training truck like in front of their house. So we're like, oh, okay. So they're actively working on some training. And then inevitably these dogs just end up in the backyard barking all day long, running around. It's almost like the idea, and I'm not saying this is the case in every situation, but the idea of having these like gorgeous shepherds, they don't tend to think about what goes into an animal that has such drive and such energy that you have to have an outlet for that, or else they're just going to be terrors in the house.
Yeah, the amount of time and effort it takes, a lot of people just aren't willing to, most people just don't know. They don't know how much time and effort it takes. And then once they get one and learn how much time and effort it takes, most people aren't interested in doing it. So they either end up in a shelter or, like you said, they end up in the backyard just barking all day long because they have nothing, and barking and digging and destroying things because they just don't have another outlet.
Yeah, pretty sad. But I mean, that's the issue we see with every breed. Same with Australian Shepherds and some of the cattle dogs, the working breeds. They're gorgeous dogs, but they take so much work. And people don't do that research before they have a dog in front of them that now it's eating my house and it's destroying everything. And yeah, maybe if you'd done a bit of research before getting that dog, it would have been a better situation. So you mentioned Radar's 10, and so he's nearing retirement. What is retirement going to look like for Radar?
He will just be spending the majority of his day in the outdoor kennel at home while I'm working. Weather dependent. He's got I got a nice spot for him to stay in the garage if it's too hot or too cold outside. But in my estimation, I have a pretty nice outdoor kennel for him. And he'll just spend the majority of the day there. And then I'll have to spend some more time with him off duty than I spend with him off duty now. Because off duty now, it's mostly, unless I'm out, I let him out, or we go on walks, or we go on runs. But when I'm not bringing him to work, I'm going to have to spend some more time letting him out and playing with him, because he's just not going to have that. He's not going to have that effort, that time out like he gets at work right now.
And is it common that most of the canine partners will retire with the person that has been handling them?
It's common here. I don't know how it is across the country. It's difficult to find a place to place a police dog once they've retired if the handler doesn't want to keep them, because the dogs never, we can't untrain them. And so if we're going to give them to somebody else, it has to be somebody that understands the limitations of having a dog that wants to bite people. We have them. There was a handler that retired from the team not too long before I joined the team, and he didn't want to keep his dog. And so it went to the supervisor of the team, who was a prior handler, didn't have any current working dogs, but he was a prior handler and the supervisor of the team. And he had a property and the ability to keep that dog. And he actually had a couple of retired police dogs. So we can find people, but typically the handler will keep them. Sometimes it's difficult because we'll get another dog. It's like when Radar retires, I've been back and forth on getting another dog. Currently, I'm in the probably going to get another dog boat, but I'm going to get another dog, or handlers will get another dog, and the dogs don't necessarily get along. And so if you keep your retired dog and then you get a new police dog, now you've introduced this new routine at home where you have to make sure that one dog gets out while the other dog's not out. They can't be out together. Depending on what kind of family you have, your family has to understand that the dogs can't get out together. The logistics become a little more difficult if you keep your old dog and get a new dog. So there are reasons to not do it, but in general, up here, most of the handlers keep their retired dogs.
And do you know how these dogs do in retirement? Because you can't just tell them, you're done working now, chill, you're retired. I imagine they still want to work.
Yeah, they do. I don't have a lot of experience with retired dogs since I've been on the team for 9 years. I've been the supervisor of the team for 6 years. And in that time, only one handler has retired a dog. All the other dogs have just died. Yeah, only known one. His dog retired at 12. He worked 10 years retired at 12. An amazing dog. Just the most talented dog that I've ever seen, police dog wise. And actually had a couple of knee replacements while it was in service. Had an organ removed, an emergency organ removal. Just kept working. This dog it kept working right up until one day its back legs just didn't work anymore. And so he retired it and then rehabbed the dog. Stark was the dog's name. So he rehabbed Stark, and now Stark's his pet, basically. But he doesn't always talk so affectionately about Stark's attitude, because Stark can be a jerk when he doesn't get to go to work, and he doesn't get to go to work anymore. So he definitely sees a difference in the dog's attitude, that it can't go to work and it can't do its job anymore. So it's definitely, it is a frustrated dog. So he tries to keep it happy. He tries to keep it busy at home, but it's clearly frustrated that it can't go to work.
Yeah. Did he get another dog too?
He did not. No, we tried to get him another dog, but the agency, my agency believed he'd been on the team long enough. So no second dog for him.
I was going to say, there must be a certain amount of jealousy too from the dog that is retired and no longer able to go, but sees this new dog going to work.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I don't know. I know that the only thing I can compare it to, not taking another dog to work, but there are times where I go to work without Radar. There are some roles or some jobs I have. I'm on the SWAT team as well. And there are times where I go off to do a mission with the SWAT team, and it's a mission where I know I'm not going to take the dog and I'm not going to need him. And it's better to leave him at home in a kennel for 10 or 12 hours than it is to put him in a tiny little car for 10 or 12 hours, because I won't have the ability to get him out. And so there are times when I leave without him, and I can hear him very fussy in the kennel, barking and whining as I'm driving away. And I don't know how long it lasts because I'm not here. My neighbors don't complain. So I don't think he barks and whines the whole time. I think he just barks and whines a little bit as I'm leaving. But I imagine it would be if I was leaving with a different dog.
Yeah, I bet it would be. So I'd love to chat about Radar's Instagram fame. How did all of that start? Was it you and Radar had snacks before you ever started filming it? Or did you just have this idea to have a little snack time with Radar?
We had an account, just an Instagram account, for a few years, and just doing the regular old boring police dogs canine account. I don't know. I wasn't really on Instagram much before I started the accounts. I didn't have a lot of examples of what to do or what people were interested in. And so I've always, and still to this day, I've always just done what's interesting to me, because if it's not interesting to me and if I'm not having a good time, I don't see a reason to do it. And I didn't actually share food with him a lot. And I think one of the first videos there's a sausage festival up here in a little town called Verbork. There's the Verbork Sausage Fest every year. And every year the sheriff's office goes up and works festival. We do security up there. And so I got some sausage and some sauerkraut, and I was eating a couple of pieces of sausage, and I decided to film it and share with him. And I liked the video. It got the same amount of likes that all my other videos got in the teens. I don't know what it was, 12, 13 likes. And then, so every once in a while, I just shared something with him. Not often. Shared some Pringles or shared a rice cake or something. It wasn't often. It wasn't a part of the regular account, a feed. And then someone suggested one time, they said that every time they see a Popeyes, they get their dog some biscuits. So I thought, okay, that sounds fun. So I got a little box of biscuits, and I shared Popeye's biscuits with Radar. And that video at the time went viral. I don't remember how many people saw it, but it was a lot. I was overwhelmed with the amount of people that were responding to the Popeye's biscuit video. So we started doing it more regularly, still not real often, but we did it more regularly. And we decided to go one day. I went to Chick-fil-A and I got some waffle fries, and that video, I think, put us on the map, the waffle fry video. I'm not exactly sure. Sometimes I don't understand the algorithm completely, the Instagram algorithm. And I think I just got lucky pairing some videos with some songs that were popular or some songs that hit the algorithm just right. And I really enjoyed, just me, I enjoyed making or editing the Chick-fil-A waffle fry video. I added music to it, but I did the timing. The timing of the music was really fun. And that, I think that made it pretty popular. And so we've basically transitioned to just sharing food. That's really, we just share food now. That was enough. People, I don't really understand it, and that's fine, but people want to see us eating food every day. And so we almost every day we share something and share the video, pair it with some music. I think at one point, I don't recall how long ago it was, but at one point I decided that I was going to share some of his food. So someone sent us some dog treats, and I decided, well, he eats my food, I'll try his food. And so I tried some of these dog treats. They weren't terrible. They weren't great. I'm not going to eat them again, but they weren't the worst. It wasn't the worst thing I've ever eaten. And so we started doing that as well. So he eats my food, I eat his food. We try everything. If someone sends it, I'll eat it. We started ranking. I don't remember when I started. I really don't remember how a lot of it. It's just a ball.
Yeah.
So I started ranking the food. There's crunchy level, my excitement, his excitement, how drooly he is over the food, overall score. And the scores don't really mean anything. They're not official. That, you know, that it's fairly arbitrary, the numbers I give it.
Don't tell people that.
Oh, everyone knows. Most people know. Most people know that it's arbitrary. It's not completely random. I do score things high if one of us or both of us like them, or pretty low if I don't like it. He eats everything but bananas.
Oh, interesting.
He enjoys everything. So I have the scores now. And there's a theme to the videos. People have been watching for a while. They understand. They know the theme. The theme is generally that the music is often relevant to the food that I'm eating. And there's just some elements in the video that are consistent that I think have just created some of the enjoyment of watching. I've enjoyed doing it.
Yeah. Also, as somebody who has dogs that one of my, like my pity, we joke that if you look at him wrong, he gets hives. He's on the most expensive diet and he's allergic to everything. So I watch these videos and I'm like, Jesus, Radar must have an iron stomach. He just eats everything. He's never had an issue with anything that you fed him.
No.
Wow.
I feel bad. Some people, they look at, like you said, they look at their dog wrong and their dog gets gas, or all of a sudden if they feed him three extra pieces of kibble, their dog's going to have diarrhea or something. But no, Radar doesn't. He's not affected. He doesn't get gas. He doesn't get diarrhea. I haven't fed him anything yet that had a negative effect on him. He has eaten things that he wasn't supposed to eat, but it wasn't food. So he's had surgery 3 times to remove things from his intestines, but it wasn't food. So now he has some digestion issues, but it's not related to what he's eating. It's related to the scarring in his intestines.
Interesting. So what are these digestive issues?
I take him running. It's basically run. If he's active, I say running, but if we have a long track or if he's active for a while, he's going to get diarrhea.
Oh.
But it doesn't matter what he's eaten. It's from running. If I can't take him running. I took him running the other day for almost 7 miles. It was a little too far for him. He was pretty tired when we were done. But that used to be fairly common, five to six, 7 miles for him. And he was guaranteed to have to start getting diarrhea around mile 3 or 4. It's just he can't run without getting diarrhea. but that happens working as well. If we're tracking for a long time, or if we're working, or if he's active for a long time, he's going to get diarrhea.
Oh, interesting. And it's just because of that scarring in his intestines?
I think it's related to the scarring. I don't know for sure, but I think it's related to the scarring because it got worse after the surgeries. Two of them happened within a couple of weeks of each other. So the first one happened before I got him. The guy who was raising him, I tell everybody that we get our dogs from Europe, but I got Radar from Fresno, a European line, a breed, but he's from Fresno, California. And the guy who was raising him before me was just feeding him as a pet in the backyard. And he'd been grilling and saving the grill grease in a can And to keep Radar from eating the grill grease, he covered the can with a pair of his wife's pantyhose. And Radar just ate the pantyhose and it got stuck. And so he had to have surgery to have the pantyhose removed. Then a few years ago, Radar started getting sick. He started losing a bunch of weight. He was vomiting a bunch. And so I took him into the vet and they took an x-ray and saw something in his intestines and they pulled out this toy. I'd never seen it. I don't remember seeing him eat it. I usually see him eat everything. I had kenneled him while we were out of town. So I think he may have gotten something when he was at the kennel, but he had this little stuffed animal. I think it was an owl. I'm not 100% sure because it didn't have a face, but this little stuffed toy, maybe the size of one of my fingers, like in length, got stuck in his intestines. And so they had cut that out and sewed him back up. And then as soon as he was, I think it was less than 2 weeks later, they were taking the stitches out and he got the same, he started having the same issues, started vomiting, losing weight, couldn't keep things down. And they found that he had something else. So he'd eaten something while he was at home, recovering from surgery. So my daughter, my kids are moved out of the house now, but at the time she'd been eating chocolate. Just chocolate chips right out of a bag of chocolate chips. And she left the bag on the counter with, I don't know, 10 or 15 chocolate chips left in it. And my pet ate it. And because my pet Bullet, his intestines are fine, he went out in the backyard. He pooped it out into the backyard. Well, then Radar found it and he ate it. And so that got stuck. The little bag of chocolate got stuck in his intestines.
Oh, he ate the whole bag?
He ate the whole bag, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Bullet had eaten it and pooped it out, so it came out looking like a little pellet. I saw it in the backyard. I just didn't pick it up because I was letting Radar run around. I didn't realize he'd eaten it because why would he? So when it came out, when they did surgery and they pulled it out, I recognized that I had seen that in the backyard. So yeah, he ate the whole bag, but it got stuck in the same place. And so he's got significant scarring in that spot on his intestines.
Yeah, I'm hoping this was a while ago. Is he over this? He's over this foreign body?
It was a few years ago. Maybe 2 years ago? I don't know. I can't. He basically eats whatever he can get his mouth on. It's just that normally it's a living thing or a recently living thing. He eats dead stuff. He eats dead stuff all the time. But typically when he's eating something, it's something that's biodegradable. Anytime the two things that he's gotten stuck in his intestines that I saw come out of his intestines were not biodegradable and I didn't see him eat them. So I don't know. I hope he's done. Who knows?
Oh, Radar. We had, I think it was a dead squirrel or something on our walk route and my dog just picked it up and I saw her pick it up and I'm like, let it drop it. And she had diarrhea for days after just putting it in her mouth. What the heck? They need some of this resiliency that Radar has.
I have video, some body cam video somewhere of Radar, of me wrestling a dead squirrel out of Radar's mouth because he tried to eat it. He probably would have eventually eaten it, but it smelled so bad and it was so leathery that I was able to grab one end and he had the other end. And we played tug of war for a little bit. I could actually hear it coming out of his throat as I was pulling it away from him. And it smelled so bad, I had to throw my gloves away because I couldn't get that smell of, I couldn't get the dead squirrel smell off of my gloves. And so I had to throw them away. But that's his favorite. That thing smelled, it smelled as bad as any dead body I've ever smelled. So he's all about that kind of stuff.
Oh, that was another question I had. Does he track the smell of living humans or will he, is so cadaver dogs are a different?
Correct. Different scent pattern. We say fresh human scent is the way we describe it. He tracks fresh human scent. It's a distinctly different odor than death. So cadaver dogs have to actually train with rotting body parts to get that odor. He will not hunt for a dead body.
Okay. So that's, yeah, a whole different training path that they would go down if they were being cadaver dogs. Do you at the canine unit have dogs that are specifically trained in cadavers?
We don't. We call search and rescue. Search and rescue has cadaver dogs.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending all this time with me chatting about Radar. I have one more question, and maybe you've been asked this before, But has anyone told you that you and Radar look alike?
Yes, yes. I get that. I get that frequently, mostly when I let my beard grow out a little bit, and you can see how gray my beard is, and it matches Radar's gray muzzle. There is a video, I don't know how far back it is, but there is a video where I put a pair of my reading glasses on Radar. So we both have the gray beards, but we also are wearing a pair of these glasses.
Oh my God.
So I leaned into it a little bit at that moment. But yes, I have been told.
Good. Okay. I wasn't sure if you were told that, because I know they say that people end up looking like their dogs. And I've never really quite seen it before, but your videos, I'm like, okay, you and Radar look a lot alike.
Yeah, I've heard. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'll have to look up that video with the glasses and share that.
Yeah, it's back there. It was one of the earlier videos, not earlier in the account, but earlier in our actual popularity. So it's back there a while.
Well, I appreciate you spending this time chatting with me. This has been so fun. Like we had chatted about before, I'm a little bit obsessed with police dogs because I'm just amazed at everything that they can do and how in tune they are with their partner. I'm assuming that's maybe not always the case, but they just seem so bonded. I don't know if that's even the right word, but just so in tune with the person that's handling them, that drive that I just don't see with my pet dogs. So I'm just fascinated by them.
Yeah.
So yeah, I very much appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. This has been awesome.
Absolutely. It was fun. I had a good time. I'm available for any other time about police dogs or Radar.
Cool. You're opening up a whole... I will be texting you now to ask about, hey, we just watched this video.
I'm here for it.
This has been awesome. Thank you again, Sergeant O'Reilly, for chatting with me. I'm trying to figure out how to get some good Kansas City barbecue out to you and Radar, which I suspect will top both the Messy and Drooly scales. And with that, we are wrapping up season one with a great big bow. Stay subscribed to the podcast, as I do have some planned bonus episodes to tie you over until we're back with season two. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on season two, now would be a perfect time to get in touch. You can direct message me on Instagram at animalsoulmatespod or send me an email, which is at animalsoulmatespod@outlook.com. I also wanted to thank all of my guests who have shared their stories on the podcast. I have learned something from every single one of you. Whenever I get the first cut of an episode, I always take my dogs for a walk while I listen and make notes. It's just sort of my process. And I catch myself either smiling like a crazy person or crying with you guys all over again. When I had an idea to start a podcast about a year ago with this goal of normalizing pet loss grief and exploring the true power of the human-animal bond, I never thought I'd be able to connect with such amazing people this early on. To Eduarda, Kristen, Prue, Karen, and Crystal, thank you for trusting me to honor your animal soulmate stories. I hope we were able to do justice to all that Dexter, Kona, Stevie Wonder, Rana, and Freya mean to you. Finally, I want to thank you, the listeners of this podcast. Let me know what stories you'd like to hear next season. Now, everyone, go be with your animal soulmates, and I will see you very soon. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Animal Soulmates podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a positive rating or review. Follow us on Instagram at Animal Soulmates Pod for updates and pictures of our guests with their beautiful animal soulmates. This podcast is produced by Citizens of Sound. Our theme song is Mastering the Art by Big Score Audio. Have a story that would be a good fit for the show? Send me an email at animalsoulmatespod@outlook.com. That's animalsoulmates with an S, P-O-D, @outlook.com. Finally, are you thinking about adding an animal to your family? Why not consider adoption through your local animal shelter? There are plenty of dogs and cats just waiting to become someone's animal soulmate. See you next time.